Now back to the Green Architect's Lounge.
You can never hit the rim rate prediction for a variety of reasons.
That's very interesting. We usually do better than that. We get the rim rate model, and we're usually better than
I don't know if that's an old rule of thumb and rim rate's improved itself in the last 10 years. I don't know.
I think it's because rim rate doesn't pay any attention to thermal bridging, and if we address thermal bridging, then
you're doing better than rim rate. Interesting.
Yeah. We're in Phil's studio with Martin Holliday. Thanks for tuning back in for part two. We're shooting the breeze there, but we're about ready to do our part two of our podcast, which we're calling Sprout Follies, which is the newly green. Those who have just joined, hopped on the bandwagon with us, you know, welcome aboard, but we're calling you Sprouts for this podcast. And that's okay. I was a Sprout once.
You were looking at me when you said that, Chris. I noticed. What are you saying?
I was looking at Martin.
Martin, it's great to have you here. Yeah. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be in Maine here with the famous Green Architects Lounge architects.
Awesome.
Even though they didn't offer me a drink, only a glass of water.
You know, that's bad form, isn't it?
It is, okay.
We had a special exception to try to fit this in today that we didn't want to get Martin too tanked before our event this evening, but we'll make it up to you twofold later, I promise.
I'll hold it to that.
Maybe, so listeners, stay tuned, part three. No, there's no part three. Stay tuned. Maybe there'll be a last tag where I'll drag this laptop and a microphone into a pub or something. We don't know what we're doing after this.
I love the idea.
I know. That would be cool. So stay tuned. We'll see if we did it. If it's not there, then we just went out and forgot about you people. Sorry. Let's get to it.
Let's talk it. The Sprout Follies. Okay. So essentially, false assumptions from those who are new to green design and construction.
Right.
Like you come in and say, all right, I like green. I want to do green. I know some of it. And here are the first things that I learned. But once you dig into it a little deeper, you think,
If I'd done it over,
you know, that's what I think. The answer is never as simple as it seems, at first.
For example?
For example. And, you know, Chris and I had this idea, so we thought we'd bring them up and then toss it out to Martin and sort of, what do you think? Are we on board? Is this a good Sprout topic? Triple glazed windows are always a good idea, Martin.
Well, I would say they usually are in northern cold climates, mm-hmm. if the customer can afford them. But down south, it makes less and less sense to put your money. The trouble right now is triple glazed windows are a significant bump up in cost.
Right.
And the people who look at the cost of making a triple glazed IGU compared to a double glazed IGU say the upcharge shouldn't be that much. But it's a little bit complicated by the fact that you need a heavier frame.
Yeah.
You need heavier hardware for a casement or a tilt turn for almost whatever you have. You end up with a thicker window often, and that means redesigning everything. So I think that if triple glazed windows ever becomes the norm for all new construction in, let's say, the entire state of Vermont or Maine or Massachusetts, the economies of scale will bring the price down. Mm-hmm. But right now, they cost a lot.
Right. That would be the folly is there that you might be spending your money on windows where you could be spending it more effectively somewhere else.
I was interested to note that there were a bunch of entrants to a passive house design competition for New Orleans recently.
Yes, and our office entered one.
Exactly, and most of the entrants, but not all, found that you can hit passive house quite easily in New Orleans with double glazed windows.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That means you save the money.
Lucky guys.
The money could be spent on something else. And perhaps you've got, you know, a thicker insulation in your walls or somewhere else where the money's better spent. So you have to use your thinking app. I think up north, though, for a new construction window, the upcharge is well worth it, with a possible exception of on the south side, where solar gain is better with double glaze than it is with triple glaze. Triple glaze still is a better year-round performance, but if you want to save money, you could make triple glazed on your east, west, and north, and leave your south double glazed.
Right.
Okay, so Sprouts, put an asterisk next to that.
Exactly.
Triple glaze coming.
What's next, Bill? What else?
Radiant flooring is always a good idea.
No.
What do you guys say? Let's hear your viewpoint, and then I'll chime in.
All right. Well, I think it's a classic. It depends answer because it depends on what your house is, how big your house is, and what the heat demand is on that house. If you've got if you have a 5,000 square foot, reasonably tight house that's big and, you know, how green is that? Well, that's not the question right now, but it's like how, you know, radiant floor, that's a good system for that. If you're delivering the heat from a radiant standpoint, yeah, that may be. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing a passive house, well, your demand is so low that the amount of hardware you're going to, I mean, the tubing and you know, what you're going to, you know, just in terms of hardware, that's more than you need. And plus, the temperature of the water that's going through that thing is going to be so low that you're never going to,
You're not going to feel it. Yeah.
And, you know, well, we found, like, you know, you could do a lot better with your money.
Exactly. You save your money. And we're finding that, you know, again, there's some cases where it's a nice thing.
Yeah.
But there are also some cases where these tight homes that we're doing now, and we should be doing, that the heat doesn't really even kick on.
Right.
And it actually feels cold most of the time. It extracts the heat from your body, and you've got a cold floor, and you think
I have a house where we did that.
The heat just doesn't get the call for heat.
Right.
And especially if your option was you were thinking about a wood floor, but you switched to concrete because you thought the concrete slab with the embedded PEX tubing would be more comfortable, and you have that condition you described where you don't need to have the heat come on, the concrete is going to feel worse than the wood floor would have.
Right.
And the bare feet on the warm floor phenomenon happens rarely in a well-insulated house. What Alex Wilson said, which I think is a good observation, that a lot of people who have cold floors, especially if they're living in a slab-on-grade home, are living on an uninsulated slab, and they hate that.
Yeah.
And they say, well, you know, why is my floor so cold, and the next house I build is going to have a radiant heat floor?
Uh-huh.
And what Alex says is, what you really want is an insulated slab, and
right.
you're going to get 3/4 of the benefit you imagine in your head with just insulating your slab.
Yeah,
but you don't really need the tubing. What you really need is insulation.
And can we say that if you have a radiant slab and you're not insulating underneath it, wow, that's inefficient. I mean, because you're shoving half your heat, you know, right into the ground.
In general, I agree completely. It's a lot of hardware, and all you really need to do is improve your envelope, improve your windows, improve your air tightness, so you don't need much heat. And then, if you don't need much heat, you can deliver it almost any which way, and you'll be comfortable.
Right. That said, I mean, it is efficient with the higher BTU demand houses. So, in my opinion.
And if you're if you've got a service station or a garage and you're working on cars all day and you're often on a creeper under the car, then warm slab would be nice. It helps melt the snow off the cars when you're working in a garage.
Or if you have an environment where it opens itself up and then closes again,
right.
You know, you lose all the air. And then, you know, if you have a high mean radiant temperature, that's to your benefit. So it's good there, too.
All right. Well, this is an interesting one. I threw this in there just because of some exercises that we had been batting back and forth recently.
Yeah.
Always shade your windows 100% in summertime.
Oh, dude, I'm just hitting this because, but not with a passive house, right, Phil? That's what you're about to say?
Well, we are interviewing Martin here, right?
Okay, yeah. Yes,
I was
so I'll turn
it over. No, because Martin, you're going right through this now, but I'm
curious.
Yeah,
I'm going through this. But...
Well, my disclaimer is I haven't played around with PHPP software very much. I've been to a couple of workshops where I've seen it on the screen and I understand the concepts, but I haven't been trained in PHPP. Mm-hmm. But I know from my own house that I appreciate solar gain in summertime through my east windows. When that sun comes up, and I want my house to be warmed up even in July because I live in northern Vermont. I don't have air conditioning. I light my wood stove sometimes in the middle of summer. So climate, that's
right.
What I'm saying. It, of course, you know, if you're in Las Vegas, you probably do want to shade your windows in summertime on all orientations.
Right.
So there's no generalization with anything.
Right.
In Maine and in Vermont, summer heat gain is sometimes useful, especially on the east, probably not on the west. But what's your experience?
Well, you know, up until recently, you know, I did the classic thing where I would study the shading on the house and make it so that when it's summer, peak solar angle of summer, which is in June, which really isn't the hottest month of the year, but, you know, that's, you know, you play with that to minimize the solar gain in that, and then you maximize the, you know, the winter sun, you let all that in. Classic textbook passive solar kind of design. Well, what I've learned with a passive house in a cold climate, you know, the thing that gets us is that 4,755 BTU per square foot per year. We are battling for that. So it's like heat gain. We want it all. So it's like, don't shade a thing. You know, the model helps you. I mean, if that is your targeted goal from a passive house standpoint, you want really, you want seasonal shading. That's the only way you're going to do it.
Here's the question. How sophisticated is the model? Because I've seen some passive house designs, one of them in New York State, with these massive walls of glass on the south side and insufficient roof overhangs from a passive solar perspective.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the model is pushing for that gain.
Yes.
Because the gain is annualized.
Exactly.
But I'm wondering whether that is a sophisticated enough software to prevent overheating in March. Because it may be true that on an annual basis you need the heat.
That's exactly
right. But we don't live on an annual basis.
Right.
And I've designed houses that melt the butter that you leave out on the kitchen countertop in March because they get so hot with solar heat gain in March. So that's the question. What do you think? Do you think the PHPP accounts for that overheating?
I do not think it does. I think it's got, it definitely has stuff to run on the cooling side of the program. But here in our cold climate, you know, it's balanced towards wanting heat gain. We're fine. It's easy to cool a house up here in the summer. You barely need anything. So that model says, bake that place, you know.
Which
so,
is a big passive house controversy, really.
It
in
is,
my mind,
it is. Yeah.
That they're not as concerned with overheating.
Right.
Really,
so I guess I would say we need to wait and see how these houses perform. I don't have enough experience with the houses that I'm writing about and seeing pictures of that are being designed right now. And people have lived in some of these houses for 6 months. I would like to interview these people in 5 or 10 years and say, you know, if you left your house closed up and went off to work on a March morning on a sunny day, when you came back at 5 p.m. and opened the door, did you get a blast of hot air like your house overheated?
Yeah.
Or did it run beautifully like a top?
Yeah,
nice.
Good question.
Yeah, I'll just add one more thing to that. Like just today, I was talking to Mark Rosenbaum about this on our house, and he said that he basically said to Kat, you know, Klingenberg, you know, he said, I'm finding that you can't do a passive house in this cold climate without seasonal shading, without, you know, shading that you can adjust or take off or move. And she said, yeah, that's pretty much what we're finding too. And I'm like, what? No one has said that out loud in a public forum before. Mm. So I'm doing it, and I'm doing it by proxy, which is right now. So we'll let them... I'll let them know I said that, and they can scramble and say, no, wait, but I meant, or they'll say, yeah, that's right. So,
interesting.
Yeah, it
very
is.
Interesting. Still on the move with that one.
All right. How about spray foam, Phil? Spray foam, as Folly would say,
yeah.
Just use spray foam. It's the best stuff. It's the best insulated stuff. R7 per inch. Let's use that.
Spray foam, this question, is spray foam is always great?
I say no, but
I say no too, but I don't know if we say no for different reasons.
Martin,
you go first this time.
Well, I think we've all begun to pay much closer attention to the global warming potential of the propellant, not the propellants, the...
Chemicals themselves that get mixed together and blown, right?
The blowing agents, the words I'm searching for. The blowing agents used in closed-cell spray foam and in XPS are very, are 1,400 times more, have more, 1,400 times more global warming potential than CO2. So very small amounts are having a huge effect on the atmosphere. And this is enough of a concern that most green builders are doing everything they can to avoid the use of closed cell spray foam, and yes. Now, open cell spray foam uses water as a blowing agent and has not been slandered as much.
Mm-hmm.
But we are also hearing increasing problems of lingering odors in a few problematic houses.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them nightmares where they have to come back and scrape every single little piece of cured foam out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are living in a hotel for months. And we're also hearing of problems of shrinkage where spray foam has been installed and then pulled away from the framing members for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the good applicators don't do this, and they say it's sloppy installation or bad temperature for your tanks or it's installer error. That said, it's a risk. And so because of all these problems, people are saying, yeah, you know, once you have one bad spray foam job, you kind of lose your enthusiasm.
Yeah.
So those are some of the problems that we've been hearing. But I would say, especially with open cell foam, it's still a great product. And even closed cell foam is unbeatable for air sealing.
Yeah.
And for rim joists and for retrofit work where you're going up into an attic and trying to plug those stubborn air leaks, you know, it's a great product with wonderful features. But that doesn't mean you need to fill all of the framing bays of a whole house as your primary insulation material using this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how I approach it too. Is I use it for the tough spots,
right?
And then that's pretty much it for spray foam. And does is XPS and EPS? And for the listeners, we're talking about extruded polystyrene versus
the blue stuff.
The blue stuff
versus white stuff.
Expanded polystyrene, which is your styrofoam cup.
The coffee cup.
Exactly. Yeah. Now the blowing agent does EPS. EPS is not as bad as XPS. Is that correct?
Right. The EPS doesn't have the global warming potential problem that XPS does.
Right.
But the EPS sold in America has the same problematic
fire retardant
chemicals that are used in XPS. There are XPSs and EPSs sold in Europe without these dangerous brominated fluorocarbon. No, what are they called? Brominated?
That's right. Bromiated?
They're the bad ones, the bad flame retardants. Which you can read about on Alex Wilson and my blogs.
But exactly.
The point being that the best rigid foam is polyisocyanurate.
That's right.
Because it is doesn't have the bad global warming blowing agents, and it doesn't have the bad fire retardants. However, of course, it can't be used below grade. So below grade, we're stuck with other problem.
Right. It also has the highest R value too.
It does have high R value. So if you're putting foam on your walls or on your roofs or correcting a thermal bridging problem, polyiso is the way to go.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
And the only one thing that I would add against spray foams is our flexibility question. You have to get in and change things over time, and we're a lot more locked in with the spray foam. So if we can get cellulose in there.
You're literally locked in. You're
boy, that's a piece of cake. So let's think about other things.
Well, what about fiberglass? That's the next folly.
What about fiberglass?
Fiberglass is
always bad. And we actually debated this a little bit before we even got on the air. I feel a little icky about ever advocating for fiberglass. Remember, we had our insulation podcast. And,
right, that's right. Way back.
I think you had to bleep me, Chris.
Sheila would bleep you for
just about anything.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
But we respect her and love her for that.
Yeah.
So the thing that we started discovering when we started doing houses out of state, we're doing a couple now in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and the builders look at us and say, cellulose?
What are you talking about?
What do you mean? And say, well, what do you got? You know, we don't want to use spray foam because of some of the questions, some of the things we just discussed. So we'll blow in fiberglass. How about that? And, you know, the truth is that you can make a pretty tight house when you blow in fiberglass.
Yeah, and in that scenario, you're depending on not your insulation to create that tightness. You are trying to make a very still air cavity that the fiberglass resides within.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of the bad reputation of fiberglass bats has to do with the fact that it comes in a bat. And the bats don't fit around electrical outlets. They don't fit around horizontal wiring. They don't fit around pipes, which hopefully you don't have in the walls, but some people do. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they get smooshed in there, and there's all kinds of air pockets, and they don't fit. So once you blow in your walls with blown-in fiberglass, that does a great job towards solving most of the performance problems of fiberglass bats. You still have the question about embodied energy.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a lot of embodied energy in concrete, but people don't knock concrete as much as they knock fiberglass. We have our little favorite things to knock.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with blown-in fiberglass.
It makes a better sound when you knock concrete.
Yeah.
That's my...
Because there's formaldehyde in a lot of them, though.
There is formaldehyde, although there are formaldehyde-free products as well, as far as I know. But if you can have a spray-in product that goes in all the nooks and crannies, I think blown-in fiberglass does great. In attics, it isn't so good. It's really low-performing. I think it's like R value of 2.3 per inch for blown-in fiberglass in an attic.
Is that because it gets wind washed?
It just doesn't get as dense. It's so fluffy. It doesn't, and if there's any air infiltration at all or wind washing, it performs very poorly. Some people who have blown-in fiberglass in their attics have gotten so sick of it, they'll go and cap it with 3 inches of cellulose, so that goes a long ways towards solving the problem, because you get a little bit of a dense layer on top that stops the air movement through the fiberglass. Although even then, if you have a huge attic with lots of depth, all of these problems can be solved by blowing it deeper. I mean, if you want fiberglass and you just do the math and say, okay, it's R2.5 per inch, and you're willing to blow 24 or 30 inches of the stuff, it can perform fine. So a lot of it's just knowing how it performs and knowing where to use it.
See, another, but one problem I have with it is like when you're doing, even when you're installing the batch, you're supposed to be wearing, you know, a mask and all right. that stuff. Because what's you know, fiberglass isn't bad for you until it's airborne and inhaled. So what do? We chop it up in tiny little bits and air, you know, propel the thing through the air. I mean, it seems like the wrong way to install fiberglass. But though I get
what's the worst possible thing to do?
Exactly.
You know, if you want to siphon it by mouth, would be slightly
exactly.
That should go.
Chew it up and spit it on.
Nevertheless, fiberglass is not asbestos.
That's right.
It does
That's
not
right.
cause cancer, as far as we know. Although there are some warning labels about it, plenty of people have installed it for years and breathed it for years and are not getting the same rates of medical problems as you see if you installed asbestos in a shipyard,
right.
in Bath, Maine, for example.
Right.
All right. What's next, Bill? What's another green folly for us?
On-demand water heaters.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
They're the best way to go.
Yeah. Well, I've had clients come in because they've recently read an article, and that's another thing we'll get to. But you know, they'll come and say, and another thing I want are those, point source, on-demand heaters for my house, and you know. Sometimes it takes some convincing to say, well, it all depends on your house and it depends on your plumbing and your mechanical system and what you're using, because maybe that's not the most, you know, beneficial thing. Mm-hmm. What do you guys know? Let me know if I'm right or wrong.
Well, I think it depends. I think you see them a lot in Europe and in Asia. They are space saving, and in a very small apartment, it can make a huge difference if you can hang your water heater on a wall. Rather than take up a whole floor space of a closet of a conventional water heater. And down south, they put them on the outside of the house. They don't even have a vent, you know, it just vents to the outside and, you know, you don't take up any floor space at all. They don't have freezing problems. So in Texas, your water heater just goes outside.
Oh, wow.
So those can make sense if space is an issue. And you have to calculate the cost of the square footage. If, you know, your house is costing, you know, $150 per square foot, do you want another X square feet for your water heater.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that they're mechanically trickier. They are more likely to need maintenance and more things can go wrong with them. I like a simple, well-insulated tank-type water heater for its simplicity, its low cost, and you can swap them out without a hassle. People look at the efficiency and say, but look, I get a higher efficiency number with the on-demand heaters, and that's true. But if you're paying $2,000 for your water heater, it's going to take a while to see the savings in energy.
Right.
And most people who have inefficient hot water systems are losing a lot of their heat through piping problems. So if they had a good layout,
yes, good point.
If their kitchen and bathroom were back-to-back and their water heater were centrally located and they minimized their pipe runs and they had home-run plumbing with 3/8 or half-inch lines, not big 3/4 honking lines running 120 feet to the master bathroom at the far end of the house, that's where they're wasting the energy.
Yeah.
They would see lower energy bills. So we need to be much more intelligent about how we design our plumbing systems, and that actually can make a huge difference in your bill.
Very good.
Excellent. I like how this was Chris's, and I think this goes into a broader conversation. The last article you read, syndrome.
Right.
Yeah,
because how many times have you had somebody come in? They just read something. What's a good example? You had a good one. Just a little bit ago.
SIPs.
Yeah, like someone come in and say, yeah, oh, I just read about, you know, they found out about SIPs. They've read the product literature. Heck, they may have even gone to a class and like, whoa, this is the wave of the future.
It's the only way to go.
This is the only way to go. This is what I'm doing. Mr. Architect, build me a SIPs house.
I've just sat in a seminar about people who sell SIPs. And they told me SIPs was the way to go.
And I've done, I don't know, I think I've designed more SIP houses than have been built, because they usually get either priced out, or the builder will say, yeah, I can deliver that same performance for cheaper. Of course, they want the work rather than having it, you know, built in a shop and, you know, while they're waiting for 3 months or whatever for it to show up. But yeah, so Phil, is your client right? So I guess the last article syndrome is they're going to come in, a client oftentimes, you know, will, maybe not as a client, maybe it's a builder, maybe it's a tradesperson or another architect or somebody, just found out this awesome thing like
ground source heat pump.
Thank you, Martin. Like, oh, we're, you know, these are the best. We're going to do this because
they call it geothermal.
But they call it geothermal.
Well, not they've read the article. And they got, a geo exchange system or something like that. But, you know, I'd say to the sprout, you know, man, if you find yourself saying this is the best way to go, or it's like envelope houses, I'm going to do an envelope house,
ICFs even still.
Yeah, even ICFs. Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm going to do a whole ICF house because that's the best.
Because the salesman told me that it acts, it's effectively an R50.
Right. Not that we're knocking salesmen, because a good product representative is a very valuable team player.
And I think the bottom line is we're all going to agree all of the products we mentioned have their uses.
Absolutely. Exactly.
But they're just not the solution to every house, and sometimes they cost more than perfectly acceptable alternatives.
Exactly. So unfortunately, the answer to that, you know, someone says, you know, this is the best. Well, it depends. You know, we say that. I probably say that as the answer to, you know, annoyingly to so many questions. Well, it depends. You know, it depends on what your house is, what your energy demand is, what your climate is, Martin.
Right.
And
And the SIPs are great if you want to get a shell up very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you don't mind a house with a lot of foam. But there are some clients who say, I don't want any foam in my house. And some clients are worried about thermal bridging through the SIPs. And there are maybe some studs that go all the way through and some SIPs.
Mm-hmm. Or the formaldehyde and the, you know, OSB that's...
Right. Some people worry about OSB durability.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All of these questions. So some clients will say, SIPs are perfect for me. I want my shell up in 3 days.
Yeah.
And the SIPs are great for them. Others will say... Wait a minute, I think a double stud wall filled with cellulose will work better for my needs.
And be greener. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well said.
Great.
What else? What's the last word? Oh, yeah, I see. Well, no. Let's do the solar heat gain coefficient.
All right, yeah. The lower the solar heat gain coefficient, the better the window.
Martin?
Well, this is... The federal government had a window program where they gave incentives or tax credits for windows that were... The 30-30 window. We all remember that one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was 0.3 U factor and 0.3 solar heat gain coefficient. And the geniuses in Washington came up with one set of numbers for the whole country.
Right.
But, of course, up north, we actually want a high solar heat gain coefficient, more likely than not, especially on the south side.
Right.
Whereas down south, you want as low as possible. So the idea of coming up with one number for the whole country, a lot of energy efficiency experts started hitting their head against the wall when they heard about this tax credit program, because it means the best windows did not comply. Mm. If I got the best windows up north, triple glazed windows with a high solar heat gain coefficient, I wouldn't get the tax credit.
The holy grail of windows right there.
So, you know, you have to put on your thinking cap, you have to do some little energy modeling, and you have to decide what orientation you're talking about and what your climate is. Mm. But down south, you want a low solar heat gain coefficient. Up north, as long as you're not facing west, you probably want a high solar heat gain coefficient.
Yeah, right. And my other... corollary to that is that the highest R value or lowest U value is actually the best for windows.
Right. Now, in all climates.
In all climates,
right.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, that's become obvious over the years is that you get these great numbers, you get your U value so low that your visible transmittance is like 30%, and you can't see through these windows.
They're or
like
even lower, in many cases, considerably lower than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what are you really losing? It's barely a window anymore for what you gain.
Right, it's a tinted window.
Yeah, so you got to be gonna watch out of the bigger picture in that case.
Yep. Okay, one more. PVC is the devil. If you get... that was my terminology for it.
Say that again.
Devil.
Thank you.
As in evil. Devil. It's... No, because, you know, if you, let's say, I don't know, you watched the movie Blue Vinyl, or you read a couple of articles or learned how, you know, a whole town was purchased by Dow Chemical because of the toxicity of, you know, producing PVC back in the good old days of the 70s or whatever. You know, you start to develop this flavor for, ooh, this, you know, PVC is bad, but I mean, look around. I mean, I bet this microphone, this might be PVC that this, you know, around the shroud of this
mic. Probably is.
Yeah.
So much for green.
Yeah, and the cable, shrouding this cable, connecting my mic to the thing is PVC. I mean, it is ubiquitous, it's around us, but, so the question is, the sprout just read his articles on PVC, and now he's ready to step up on a soapbox and go, and maybe he still is. they know that PVC is bad, because it's toxic to produce, difficult to recycle, and toxic to dispose of.
It is. I mean, you know, I stand and say that it is. It is the devil. I don't think there's any argument there. In, you know, it's just, it comes down to your budget in a lot of ways. You know, well, your budget, is your budget so low that you say, I'm going to have a toxic house because that's all I can afford?
Well, toxic house is a strong statement.
Yes, it is.
So here's the question. Yeah. If you live in a house with vinyl siding, is there toxicity that will hurt your family's health? I would argue probably not. I think the toxicity occurred in the factory where that vinyl was manufactured, which is nothing to sniff at, and it's a great concern for us as a society whether we should be manufacturing PVC. But you can't jump to the conclusion that your children will be ill if there's vinyl siding on your house.
That's true. I agree with that.
I agree with that.
But it's got to start somewhere.
Right.
You know, so there's been a big debate in our office for these new German windows that have become available in the U.S. That for so long we've been looking for a good, affordable triple glazed window. And they seem great, almost too good to be true. You know, just because we can name names. The Intus windows, the Schüco windows.
The price difference.
$30 a square foot. Yeah, you know, we're talking about, you know, less than a third of some of the German windows. I mean, this is phenomenal. And the performance is just great.
Yeah, but then really you worry about longevity.
But probably. They're vinyl. That's the part you didn't say.
But they're vinyl. They're vinyl. So we are torn.
Here's the question on consistency. People sometimes, when they say, I'm building a greenhouse, they paint themselves into a corner. It's very hard to have a vinyl-free house. I mean, I think Romex cable is vinyl sheathing. So, you know, you can probably come up with some old BX cable that they still use in some parts. You can come up with different alternatives.
And you can do ABS plumbing.
But the people who say this are driving around in a car, which is 40% vinyl, and they're typing on a computer, which is 30% vinyl, and they're running to Walmart to buy their kids' toys. Now, maybe, you know,
they're 100% vinyl.
Maybe they are super greenies, and their kids only play with wooden toys made out of unvarnished maple. God bless them.
And they only have three.
And maybe they don't go on the internet, and they don't use a computer. They've never held a mouse in their hand, a plastic mouse.
Right.
A real-life toy baby. Little pet mouse.
Which they probably fed five of their pet snakes.
But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. And if you've ever been on an airplane and, you know, sat in a, you know, you can't fly an airplane without vinyl. So I don't know. I think having as low plastic as we can in choices where we do have a choice is perhaps wonderful and something to aim for. But if we are aiming for philosophical consistency, we're not going to have a vinyl-free life unless we really do move to Nepal into a high mountain village. So
that's true. You know, this is not a perfect world, but we do drive this industry, builders and architects.
You can push
it. We have a lot of responsibility. And in my mind, it's sort of our job, if we're going to be in the leading edge of this, to take a hard line.
And your hard line is no PVC. What do you do for wiring?
No, it's not. But it's we still use Romex. We're very interested in the Living Building Challenge and where that's leading us. Because, you know, we had referred to...
Which we'll do a podcast on later.
Yeah, I think it's worthwhile. But in toxicity and materials, that's something that I personally, and same with part of Jesse, are very interested in. So we're pushing that end. And
good.
So doesn't mean it's right for everyone, but that's why you'll get me fighting back a little bit on that.
Yeah, I'll fight back with you a little bit. Okay. You know, here in Maine, you know, we incinerate a lot of our waste stream, a lot of it. And there's something like 500 tons of PVC is estimated to be burned every year. Now,
that's a bad story. You don't want to burn PVC.
Exactly. So that is dioxins that if we were anywhere west of where we were, we would never get away with it if anyone cared to measure air quality. But it's going out to the ocean, and you know, we'll deal with that dioxin later. Likewise, as PVC ages, it does leach dioxin even in minute amounts, so, which is why it's not our supply plumbing probably for temperature problems and that sort of thing, but that's one reason. So I agree with both of you. Martin, we're not going to be PVC free.
I think we should have as PVC free house as we can achieve without being some kind of dogmatist about it, claiming that, you know, that's why I wouldn't call it the devil. PVC is a useful material. It has wonderful characteristics. It does, you know, make a window that lasts longer than a lot of rotten wood windows that I've bought in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So really, it's not the devil. He's sort of like your evil cousin who's saying, "Hey, let's go out and you know do whatever." You know, just pushing you in the wrong direction, making things easier. But I don't know. That was probably a bad analogy. I could do better if I had more time. You know, this is when I miss the cocktails.
Well, that being said, gentlemen, I think it's time to go enjoy a couple drinks.
I do too, and maybe we'll see if this laptop can join us with a microphone and not be ridiculous sounding. And if so, we'll give it a shot. Martin, thank you so much for stopping by and
thank doing you, the podcast.
It's been a great pleasure.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. We're after hours and we're getting the cocktail for the episode is at Sunny's in Portland. Phil, what are you drinking?
We are drinking a Peeper Ale from the Maine Beer Company.
All right.
Right here in Portland, Maine. And Martin, what do you think?
I think this is an excellent. Is this beer. An IPA? Could I call this an IPA?
You can call it whatever you want. Right.
It's a fine local brew and I'm enjoying it.
Fantastic. And that's going to have to do it. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
That's all we get?
What other smart wisdom do you have after a long day?
I've got nothing left.
That's what I thought. All right. Oh, one more thing, Phil.
Yes, Chris.
Your song, real quick.
I am so glad we didn't forget my song. This is a band called Wise Blood. The name of the EP is Plus, or the Plus Sign. And the song is called Here Comes the Sun. And I think you'll recognize a very interesting sample on it. These guys were all the rage at the South by Southwest that happened last month. And
they're not from Brooklyn?
They are actually, I have no idea where the hell they're from.
Brooklyn, aren't
they? Probably, if I don't know, they're probably from Brooklyn.
All right.
Well, I hope you guys enjoy.
All right.
Cheers,
thanks,
Chris.
Cheers, Phil. Thanks.